Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm your host for this week, Evan Davis. Well, the news this week is all about the Ukraine, it seems, though one small concession to justice was realized when the three white supremacist lynchers in Georgia were convicted in federal court on hate crimes charges in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. They were already sentenced to life in prison, and they were never going to get out. Now they're really, really never going to get out. And the prosecutor, who was apparently complicit in the cover-up, is awaiting her day in court, as well as the three Minneapolis officers who participated in the murder of George Floyd. I'm glad to see these individuals brought to justice, but unless we address the broader culture of injustice, it will always take another killing to bring another killer to account. The system will continue to be reactive rather than proactive and preventative. That means that all sentences and hate crimes penalties will be punitive, and that's a crude, antiquated form of justice, in my view. The problem is not that the racist killers shouldn't be put away, they should be, but rather that conditions that produce them remain prevalent, and the burden of deterrence falls disproportionately on legal consequences. Someone once said that it takes a village to raise a child, and if that's the case, then maybe the whole village is to blame here. And so, too, may be the case in the Ukraine situation. Western media frames it as a simple case of big bad expansionist Russia threatening and bullying innocent sovereign Ukraine, which does not enjoy the contractual obligatory protection of the Western states because it's not part of NATO. Putin, to all except Donald Trump and his Republican Party, who praised him in recent statements, is a megalomaniac who oppresses his own people and rules corruptly in a dictatorial fashion. The Ukrainians in the East, who are not aligned with the nationalist regime backed by the United States, many of them may not favor annexation by Russia, but neither are they happy with the Ukrainian regime, let alone its aspirations to join NATO. There's little discussion of the fact that NATO membership means U.S. bases and weapons right on the Russian border. We're also not being told about the Nazi component in the current Ukrainian government, nor of the long history of white nationalism and anti-Semitism among certain portions of Ukrainians. Ukraine was a hotbed of Nazi collaborators during World War II, and that cultural contingent has not only continued, but has grown in recent years, gaining a substantial foothold within the government itself, even gaining effective control over the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Putin has apparently stated a philosophy of his own, describing that most of Ukraine is actually an invented state and that it had always been part of Russia and should be again. History doesn't exactly bear that out, but Putin may have other ambitions, and on the whole, the annexation drive might be a kind of a decoy. At the same time, however, the Ukrainian economy is in a shamble. Like Crimea, it could be that Ukraine needs to depend on fluid trade with its eastern neighbor for its very survival. Ukrainian public services are dwindling, and the quality of life there is, by most measures, rapidly deteriorating. It's ironic that the Western media doesn't mention that or the cultural and political divisions within Ukraine, while it blames the necessary austerity measures in Venezuela on that country's elected administration rather than on the brutal sanctions the U.S. is imposing there. And who's to say that Putin isn't simply manipulating the United States by trying to saddle us with a political quagmire that he knows we will bumble based on our linear history of hegemonic meddling in the region? Or perhaps the Russian economy is tenuous as well, and its sights are being drawn on resources in the Ukraine. Ukrainians did vote overwhelmingly for independence and after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and certain details about Soviet governance in Ukraine may remain a bitter memory for many, but there's a long anti-nationalist movement in the east of Ukraine that has come under fire from the Ukrainian regime in the west. Perhaps there's a case to be made, from either an economic or political standpoint, for full or partial reunification, but perhaps the current regimes in both countries, as well as the international brokers, are too corrupt to entertain that notion. I think it's pretty clear that the Ukrainian citizens, especially those in the East, are caught up in a quagmire that they had little hand in creating, and they are wise to be wary of the clash of major powers that threatens to turn their world upside down. Yet their voices are conspicuously absent from Western reporting. Well, in today's show, we'll hear several perspectives, as well as a succinct history of the recent history of Ukraine and Russia relations. I had hoped to find such nuanced and in-depth material from mainstream sources, but not even NPR or Al Jazeera had much to offer. Some of this discussion will seem rather dry in comparison to the heated and bombastic rhetoric we've grown accustomed to, but the situation, as I've explained, is complex and defies the sophomoric reductionism our Western media tends to serve up. So take what you will from it, and I hope this inspires some deeper reflection on your part than we are being encouraged to manifest.
Ukraine.
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 Ukraine. You've probably heard about that country a lot. For the last few years, Ukraine has been one of the most important conflict points in the world. It's the site of a proxy war between Russia and the United States.
Russia could launch an attack on Ukraine any day now.
We are ready, and all of NATO is ready.
But it's also a place most people don't really know a lot about. So the story we hear about Ukraine's history and its conflict today has very little relationship to reality. I'm going to tell you a story about modern Ukraine, but this is also a story about America and how American money and weapons ended up in the hands of these guys, the neo-Nazis and ultranationalists of Ukraine's far right. Let's start in 1991, when Ukraine became fully independent from the Soviet Union. And independence was tough. After the fall of communism, the economies of post-Soviet republics were falling apart. State institutions were being hollowed out. A so-called gangster capitalism was becoming dominant. So in the 1990s, Ukraine's economy and quality of life collapsed, and it's never really gotten better. Adjusted for inflation, Ukraine's GDP per capita was higher in 1990 than it was in 2020. Health outcomes are abysmal. In 2019, the life expectancy of Ukrainian men was lower than in Syria, Iraq, and North Korea. And as quality of life collapsed, nationalism flourished. Some people turned to extremist politics. And that was partly because Ukrainian nationalism, formed in opposition to the Soviet Union, tended to have a strongly right-wing flavor. To understand that, we have to look at a crucial figure in Ukrainian nationalist history, a guy named Stepan Bandera. You see, in the 1930s and 40s, Bandera wanted Ukrainian independence from Poland and the Soviet Union. So when the Nazis invaded, Bandera allied with them. His followers massacred huge numbers of Poles and Jews. But in spite of this legacy, Bandera is still viewed as a hero in the west of Ukraine. There are Stepan Bandera streets, museums, and monuments. In 2010, Bandera was even named an official hero of Ukraine. But Bandera is hated in the east, where Soviet identity was historically a lot stronger. And that east-west divide was a big fracture within Ukraine. In western Ukraine, there was more stress on a specifically Ukrainian identity, closer to Europe. In eastern Ukraine, meanwhile, people were more likely to stress their historic ties to Russia and the Russian language. Fast forward to 2010, when Ukraine elected a relatively pro-Russian politician named Viktor Yanukovych as its president, with strong support from voters in the east. Yanukovych pursued a regionalist and Russia-friendly agenda, which angered people in the West. And in 2013, Yanukovych announced that he was suspending discussions on Ukrainian integration with Europe. That decision sparked a protest movement centered in Kyiv called Euromaidan, after the Maidan Square, where it took place.
In Kyiv, thousands of Ukrainians continue to protest against the government's decision to hold off on signing a deal with the EU.
In the West, Euromaidan was seen as a peaceful, pro-democracy movement. And most participants really were ordinary people who were angry at the government. But as the protests grew, encouraged by a harsh repression from the police and a brutal sniper attack that killed dozens of protesters and police alike, a new, more sinister element emerged and began to hijack the movement. The ultranationalists came on the scene.
It was often the nationalists who were the loudest and the most violent. A group calling itself the Right Sector is perhaps the largest. Its members can be seen marching around Kyiv in columns of about a dozen.
Groups like the, quote, Right Sector, the ultra-nationalist Svoboda Party, originally called the Social National Party of Ukraine, try turning those words around, acted as a small but influential organized minority within the protests. And those extremists played an important role in exacerbating the protests by encouraging violence and more radical rhetoric. There are allegations that the sniper attack was actually orchestrated by the right sector and its co-conspirators. By early 2014, the government lost the ability to control the protests.
In a rapidly evolving political crisis, President Yanukovych has been voted out by parliament, forced to leave Kiev.
And the U.S. recognized interim government that replaced him had a significant far-right faction. The deputy prime minister, the minister of defense, and others were all from that far-right party, Svoboda. And this led to backlash in the east, because eastern Ukrainians were horrified at what they saw as a far-right seizure of power, with veneration of Bandera and elimination of equal recognition for languages like Russian.
Service industry workers have since January been obliged to talk to customers in Ukrainian unless clients specifically ask to switch.
If I work, pay my employees' salaries and my taxes, it's none of your bloody business which language I do it in.
Anti-government protests broke out across the east. In the eastern peninsula of Crimea, people were furious. Many of them talked about joining Russia, so the Russian government saw an opportunity. They wanted to encourage a surge of Russian nationalism for its own benefit. So Russia annexed Crimea and held a disputed referendum to legitimize the decision.
As many as 95.5% of the electorate in Crimea have voted to join Russia. We are going back home. Crimea is in Russia.
Energized by the annexation and supported by Russian arms and military personnel, the anti-government protests became a full-blown secessionist movement. Eastern provinces like Donetsk and Luhansk held separatist referendums and declared independence. The new government branded these rebellions as, quote, terrorist actions. Ukraine entered a civil war, which was also a proxy war with Russia. But after decades of austerity and corruption, the Ukrainian army was totally unable to fight. So a lot of the action fell instead to the people who were the most violent, the ultra-nationalists. So a new paramilitary emerged. It was called the Azov Battalion. And unlike the official Ukrainian military, Azov's volunteers were willing to go the distance. But Azov wasn't just any random organization. It was a pretty disturbing far-right group. It had come out of neo-Nazi street gangs that had been used as muscle by Ukrainian elites in the 90s and 2000s. Azov members regularly sported tattoos of swastikas. Their symbol was based on a Nazi emblem. Their leader declared that their mission was to, quote, lead the white races of the world in a final crusade against the Semite-led Untermenschen, subhumans. But Azov's neo-Nazism turned out not to be such a huge concern to the Ukrainian government. Because in 2014, a guy named Arsen Avakov became interior minister in charge of police and security. And Avakov had been a longtime patron of the neo-Nazi gangs. And when he was a regional governor, he used them as enforcers. So when he became interior minister, Avakov had the Azov Battalion incorporated into Ukraine's National Guard. Ukraine is the only country to have a neo-Nazi formation in its military. So as the war was heating up, the U.S. government announced it would start helping the Ukrainian government.
We're upholding the principle that bigger nations can't bully the small by opposing Russian aggression and supporting Ukraine's democracy and reassuring our NATO allies.
It would send money, training, and, quote, defensive lethal aid, weapons. And as all that flowed in, Azov became a beneficiary. The research group Bellingcat showed that Azov was receiving access to American grenade launchers. A Daily Beast investigation showed that U.S. trainers were unable to prevent aid from reaching neo-Nazis. And Azov itself posted a video of the unit welcoming representatives from NATO. Some in the U.S. were concerned about all of this. They warned that arming neo-Nazis would pose a threat to Ukrainian minorities and to Ukrainian democracy. But whenever Congress tried to ban funding for Azov, the Defense Department had those provisions removed. So the U.S. continued funding Azov for years. It wasn't until 2018 that funding was banned, and that the State Department labeled Azov a, quote, nationalist hate group. Ukraine is still mired in a war on its territory, and the Russian government likes to use Ukrainian nationalists in its propaganda, part of its practice of painting all Ukrainians as Nazis. Of course, those claims aren't really true. But Ukraine still does have a serious and militarized neo-Nazi problem, and Western support extends beyond Azov. Even today, far-right groups continue to benefit from training by Western countries. American politicians have met with far-right leaders.
People of Ukraine, this is your moment.
During the protests, American Senator John McCain made a public appearance with a leader of the far-right Svoboda Party, this guy. He had previously been kicked out of Ukraine's parliament for extreme anti-Semitism. And here's that same guy meeting with then-Vice President Joe Biden. So since the 2014 uprising, Ukraine's far-right has become increasingly powerful. Azov veterans have been given high positions in the security services. In 2016, Andriy Poruby, pictured here when he was leading a neo-Nazi party in the 90s, became Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, even as he continued to offer praise for Adolf Hitler. Here's Poruby meeting with John McCain. The new Ukrainian government even made it a criminal offense to deny Bandera's heroism. And in 2021, the United States and Ukraine were the only two countries to vote against a UN resolution condemning the glorification of Nazism. A climate of impunity has developed around far-right violence. Attacks against Roma and gay people go unpunished. A 2018 report found that Ukraine had more incidents of anti-Semitic hate crimes than all other post-Soviet republics combined. So that's the story of how the far-right helped cause the country to fracture. But it's also a story about America, how America's support helped legitimize the far-right and allowed it to build influence. And that's a pattern you see over and over in American foreign policy. Getting involved in places that we don't really understand and supporting groups, lesser evils, that we think serve our interests. And then being surprised when the blowback hits us in the face. In Central America, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, and now in Ukraine. I'm Hadia Afzal, Advocacy Associate for Just Foreign Policy for the Gravel Institute.
President Vladimir Putin of Russia is a man of many talents, most of them shirtless. He's renowned for his peerless ability to canter on a noble steed across the Siberian plains without a shirt, to catch sockeye salmon in the freezing waters of the Russian River without a shirt, and to fell men twice his size while wearing a mostly unbuttoned judo uniform. But did you know that in addition to all these rugged talents, Putin is also an avid essayist and amateur historian? He's the Russian Indiana Jones, in a sense, if Indy were the villain in every movie. Yes, just last summer, Putin penned a whopping 5,000-word essay entitled On the Historical Unity of Russians and Ukrainians, all about how they're one people, a single whole. He goes on to question the legitimacy of Ukraine's borders, saying that the country was formed on the lands of historical Russia and can only achieve true sovereignty in partnership with the Kremlin. These theories were echoed in his aggressive speech on Monday when he declared two breakaway eastern regions of Ukraine to be independent. Over the course of Putin's remarks, he detailed a surreal version of Ukraine's history, once again questioning the country's statehood and arguing that Lenin drew its borders on historic Russian land. But as the New York Times laid out, Putin may not have all his facts straight. Ukraine is a patchwork country formed out of Russian and Polish and Lithuanian and Hungarian lands. And Lenin's government actually tried to crush Ukrainian independence by banning their language and their culture. Not to mention the rather important and very relevant fact that the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians themselves would strongly disagree with Putin's account of their history and basically his denial of their existence. Ukrainians declared their own independence in late 1991, end of the Cold War. More than 80% of eligible Ukrainians voted. And of those voters, over 90% chose independence. That includes over 80% of voters in the now Russian-backed separatist-controlled regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, as well as over 50% of all ethnic Russians living in Ukraine at the time. So, To reiterate, over 90% of Ukrainians approved independence in a free and fair referendum. Putin couldn't even get those kind of numbers for himself in Russia when he rigged his own presidential election. Just saying. So look, President Putin, it seems as though history is not your thing. I would suggest you stick with shirtless riflery or bare-chested boxing instead. Not history. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Joshua Tucker, a professor of politics and the director of NYU's Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia, and who cited in that New York Times piece on Ukrainian history yesterday. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Gary Kasparov called Putin's history lesson a screed of ahistorical grievances and delusions. What was your first impression of that speech on Monday, and what do you see as the subtext behind it?
So my first impression of the speech was to see it through the eyes of the current politics of the moment, right? So Putin is trying to make an argument here that somehow the rest of the world should see Russia's desire to infringe on Ukraine's borders at this current time as not infringing on the borders of an independent country. So one way that you're able to do this is you deny that the country has its own real history here.
So
it's also, who of was, course...
Sorry, go ahead. Carry on. So finish your point.
I was going to say, it's also the other statement of it is that in the context of the last 30 years, it's kind of a nonsense statement, right? In the context of the international system, in the context of countries in the world today, Ukraine has been an independent country at this point for over 30 years, entitled to the rights and privileges of sovereign nations around the world, recognized by countries around the world. So it's also an kind of incredibly radical statement to try to take a country that has statehood now and to walk back that statehood going back in time. And that's something that could happen with lots of countries.
So, Professor, who was the intended audience here? I'm guessing Putin didn't earnestly believe that he would convince non-Russians, especially Ukrainians, that this alternate history was true. Why did he go out of his way to write something so detailed last summer and then again on Monday in this long, rambling speech?
So we can think of two potential intended audiences here. One intended audience might have been China, trying to make an argument that Ukraine should somehow be treated the same way as Taiwan. However, China's never recognized Taiwan as an independent country, whereas Russia has recognized Ukraine as an independent country. And the Chinese don't really seem to have taken the bait on this in the last 24 hours. That points to the other probably primary audience for this, which is the Russian people themselves. Any sort of war with Russia, between Russia and with Ukraine is going to be costly, and it's going to be costly for Russia in lots of ways. It's going to be costly in terms of human costs. It's going to be costly in terms of economic costs. By arguing that Ukraine is not its own country, that Ukraine is somehow a part of Russia, my belief is that Putin is trying to signal to the Russian people, this isn't the same thing as invading another country, right? This is reunifying our country, with the hope that the Russian people will be more likely to sort of line up behind that goal than potentially other goals based around security interests or based around reestablishing the Soviet Union.
Yes, and Russia, of course, recognized Ukraine's independence in 1991 when it declared independence. It recognized Ukraine's borders in 2004 in Budapest. It recognized it in the Minsk protocols a few years ago. Let me ask you this. I asked Masha Gessen earlier in the show, how strategic is Vladimir Putin? How strategic is he or isn't he? Because he's pretty brazen in his actions right now. But at the same time, he pretends to have this polite diplomatic justification for all of these villainous plots. Right. Everyone can see what he's doing, maybe with the exception of the Chinese, as you pointed out. So what does he gain by continuing to kind of politely deny and play this? Oh, this is about our history. This is about, this is about not about just grabbing land.
So I think in the West, we often have a tendency to reify Putin and think that everything he's doing is a stroke of master genius and it's all been sort of planned out ahead of time. My sense is he's made mistakes before. There were mistakes around Crimea. Think about where Russia would be in the world today. Think about where the size of Russia's economy to be today if had they not annexed Crimea. There were mistakes made around interference in the U.S. 2020 in the U.S. 2016 elections, which probably had very little impact on the election result, but led to renewed sanctions against Russia from the U.S. at a time when the parties were fairly not unified. In this particular case here, Putin, in a sense, is being strategic in that he has a game plan and he's sticking to it. And his game plan is to lay out this narrative, right? Then the narrative was going to be there are Russians inside of Ukraine who are being harmed by the Ukrainian government, and Russia is going to come to their defense, and that this is going to be part of their responsibility because they're really, truly a part of Russia. And this is a story that the Biden administration has quite cleverly been laying out almost one step ahead of time, noting that this is what the Russians are going to do, and this is what Putin has gone ahead and done it. I think one question we have to ask, which is, you know, really nicely illustrated by the video you're just showing there, is just how isolated Putin is at this particular point in time in terms of the advice he's getting and in terms of the reality that he's believing. We know that as autocrats, when autocrats rule, and the longer they rule, the more the people around them, their careers are dependent on being subservient to the autocrat and in telling the autocrat that the autocrat is right. You throw on top of this the pandemic, where by all accounts, Putin has been incredibly isolated since COVID and really restricting action that comes to him. You can wonder if he's being strategic in the sense that he has a plan, but whether or not he's actually aware of the actual support for this plan, both among the Russian people, but also globally. And you just have to look, if you think that the goal here was to weaken NATO, that the fear was that NATO was getting too strong, it seems that everything he's doing here is actually giving renewed purpose to NATO, if anything, strengthening NATO to a level we haven't seen recently. So this is where there's this tension. Clearly, there's a plan, but is the plan actually a strategic plan? Is it one that's based in a good understanding of reality right now?
Fascinating stuff. Professor Joshua Tucker, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your analysis tonight. Appreciate it.
Never has war been more shrilly warned of and less prepared for. For months, war drums have been beating in the US media. On the brink of war with Russia, proclaims the Wall Street Journal. Possible Russian invasion of Ukraine, cries the Los Angeles Times. The US must prepare for war with Russia over Ukraine, urges Defense One, a website that claims to offer an analysis of US security. To top it all, on Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson claimed that he had evidence of a Russian plan for a lightning war that could take Kiev, although such evidence was not produced. By contrast, the Russian president, the Russian foreign minister, and other officials have repeatedly insisted that they have no intention of starting a war. Sober voices like Dmitry Trenin of the Carnegie Moscow Center have been insisting that Russia does not want to invade Ukraine. Even the Pentagon and Ukrainian President Zelensky admit that there is no evidence of an imminent incursion. While they nevertheless promote war hysteria, it is clear that neither the United States nor the West nor yet NATO is remotely prepared to face the war that they are conjuring up. The US has put 8,500 troops on standby. The British are sending lethal aid to the already unstable and precarious Zelensky government in Ukraine. But they have ruled out sending troops, preferring to praise the bravery of the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian people instead. Continental European governments, historically more inclined to trade with Russia than antagonize it, are making token gestures. Surely President Putin and the Russian army are quaking in their boots. While things remain quiet on the Ukrainian-Russian border, long-running divides within NATO are clearly opening up into conflicts. Germany refused to send military aid to Ukraine, and though he was forced to resign for saying so, the head of the German Navy insisted that there was no danger of war from Russia. President Macron emphasized that there was a need to negotiate, not fight. What the continental Europeans call their Ostpolitik has a long history. And today, with American power in decline and retreat, it is more important than ever. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline that will supply Western Europe with Russian gas is completed and is only awaiting some bureaucratic approval from the European Union. In this scenario, war is less likely to occur because President Putin wants it than because of miscalculation and misunderstanding, the likelihood of which grows with every new piece of hyperbole that emerges from the Biden administration and its closest national and media allies. So what's really going on? We know that there is a longer and deeper history to this And it involves some critically important things that are often absent from the current flurry of media coverage. Among the most important are the relentless eastward expansion of NATO since 1997, despite assurances given at the time of German unification that NATO would not expand an inch eastward. The civil war in Ukraine on the question of EU accession, usually seen as a stepping stone to NATO membership. US and Western insistence on keeping the civil war in Ukraine festering by emboldening Ukrainian governments to violate their commitments to the Minsk agreements that had been brokered by the Germans and the French between Ukraine and Russia. The stationing of NATO troops in the new Eastern European NATO member states, complete with stepped-up military exercises along the Russian border last summer, and the impending stationing of more troops in these countries. The Russian response in the form of proposed treaties and a request for written assurances about US and NATO activities on its border. Hello, this is Radhika Desai from the Real News Network. And to help us make sense of all of this, its history and the current conjuncture, are Dr. Oleg Barabanov and Dr. Boris Kagarlitsky. Dr. Oleg Barabanov is Program Director of the Valdai International Discussion Club and Professor of the Russian Academy of Sciences. He's Academic Director of the European Studies Institute at the famous Moscow National University of International Relations. And for several years in the 2010s, he was member of the Working Group on the Future of U.S.-Russia Relations, organized by the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University and the Valdai Club. For 7 years in the 2010s, he worked as a political expert for various Russian TV channels at political talk shows. Previously, he was senior research fellow at the Russian Institute for Strategic Studies. He graduated from the School of History at the Lomonosov University of Moscow in 1993. He's co-author of Valdai Club reports on relations with Russia with the Middle East, China, and the United States, on the role of values in world politics, on the role of historical memory in contemporary international relations, on the global left and right. And he has authored 6 research monographs. Welcome to the Real News Network, Oleg.
Thank you. Thank you, Radhika. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Oleg. And our second guest has been with us before, analyzing the political situation which emerged upon Alexei Navalny's return to Russia last spring. Dr. Boris Kagarlitsky is one of the best-known leftist writers, historians, and sociologists of Russia, and has also been an important political activist in Russia, both in Soviet times and today. And he offers us a distinct left perspective on Russian politics. So welcome back to the Real News Network, Boris.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here with you, Radhika.
Great. So let's start with a very simple question. And Boris, I'll aim this one at you to begin with. Although Oleg, please come in if you want to add anything more to what Boris says. So why do you think the West and the United States are claiming that Russia is poised to invade Ukraine?
Well, first of all, I think that there is a real danger of a war between these two states. And the danger is not coming really out of a particular conflict of interests between these states, though there are plenty of disagreements and conflicts, including the territorial conflict. But, however, I think this is not that important. What is really important? Because all these conflicts continued for a very long period of time and nothing changed now to make these conflicts kind of more important and more urgent, more serious now. So what is more important is a tremendous economic and social crisis in both countries, in both states. I mean, we see that whether we take Ukraine or we take Russia, the situation is very, very bad and it's degenerating very fast. On the Ukrainian side, there is a an absolutely devastating social crisis. Social crisis that is leading to the situation when, for example, the country is actually destroying its healthcare system. It's systematically destroying its own educational system. It's a very deadly combination of extreme nationalism with extreme neoliberalism. So extreme nationalism is extreme ethnic nationalism and kind of cultural nationalism combined with the very, very extreme and very radical neoliberal reforms. I mean, going probably much, much further than anywhere in Eastern Europe. And it's basically destroying the fabric of society. So in that sense, Ukrainian society is facing a tremendous crisis, and it's very important that the rating of Zelensky and his party is also collapsing. It is collapsing, and it seems that the state is in many ways failing. However, if you are looking on the Russian side, the situation is not much better. It is better, though. It is better. But it's not that much better, because Russia is rapidly going into the very same direction. It seems that every time Ukrainian elites are inventing something extremely stupid and reactionary, Russian elites immediately are doing everything to imitate the very worst of what is done in the West or in Ukraine or anywhere. For example, there is a systematic attack on culture and education in Russia, so that there is a real campaign against university autonomy with, for example, the rector of the university where I actually work, Sergei Zuev, is now under arrest, and nobody can even explain why is he arrested. I mean, it's an absolute scandal that we have such a serious high-level academic being jailed, actually. And things like that happen almost on a daily basis, not to speak about what's happening with the opposition. But all these political things are just the top of the iceberg, because the most important thing is that there is also a tremendous social and economic crisis that we see prices just skyrocketing. Public discontent is mounting incredibly. Opinion polls, even those done by the pro-government pollsters, are showing tremendous decline of Putin's ratings. And actually, United Russia, Putin's party, in fact, failed miserably in the last election, though they had to use massive electoral fraud in order to retain a majority in the Duma, in the Russian parliament. So it's a very typical situation in Russian history. When you are facing domestic problems, it's a very good idea to start a short war and probably win it. So I think both Russian and Ukrainian elites are playing with this, not necessarily with the war, but this kind of war scare. And still, I'm not completely pessimistic, because first of all, I think using war scare for propaganda purposes is one thing, and fighting a real war is a different thing. Just recently, one of my friends returned from Ukraine, and we compared the propaganda messages on both sides. They're kind of symmetrical. If you turn on Russian television every day, you see, you get messages, you get programs describing Ukrainians as monsters, as fascists, as Nazis, and so on and so on. The very same thing you get on the Ukrainian side. You turn on Ukrainian television and you get every day programs on Russians being aggressors, barbarians, presenting danger to humanity and civilization, and so on and so on. So this is absolutely horrible. But one thing is propaganda, and another thing is fighting a real war. So it's still possible, I think, to avoid a war. I think that people, even though people on both sides are reactionaries, but I don't think they're madmen. I don't think they're crazy. I hope they're not crazy yet.
Which is important to clarify, given that people in the Western media, Putin is regularly portrayed as irrational, as a gambler, etc., etc.
No, I think they're reasonable. The problem is that they can miscalculate.
Yes.
You see, it's a very dangerous game when you're playing with a war and you don't want a real war. You want to play with a war. But you can miscalculate. You can make a wrong step. And irreversible things may start happening. And
yes.
That's the most dangerous aspect of the situation.
And so what you're describing is two societies which are already racked to the core by the pursuit of neoliberal policies and a whole lot of other bad policies. And on top of that, there is the Americans who are intervening in extremely destructive ways, I presume.
I assure you, it's really very destructive because, you see, the United States is, unfortunately, it's like yet another elephant in a china shop. And you see, if you're looking at the situation on the Russian-Ukrainian frontier, I should rather say there are too many elephants in the china shop.
Yes. Oleg, would you like to add anything before we go to the next question?
Yeah, I agree what Boris has said on the economic and political situation in Russia. It's we have negative trends, that's true. Me personally, I don't think that Putin is planning a real war. For me, it's only a kind of a diplomatic blackmail. Because we've seen it already a year ago when there was some videos of Russian troops going to the Ukrainian border. There was some escalation of pre-war paranoia on the Russian television. But the idea behind it was just to organize a summit with the new US president, Joe Biden. And with this war escalation, Putin just provoked Biden to call him and they organized the meeting and everybody was happy. Because what the Putin's idea for me is not to be excluded from the world politics, from the world diplomacy, from the community of Western leaders, but to sit with them at the same table and trolling them, just trolling them. Because troll them from the Kremlin, it's not that interesting. It's better to do it sitting at the same table and looking into eyes of Biden, Johnson, and others. And now I think it's another round of the same diplomatic blackmail. And he's not planning the war. But what is important, I'd like to say, it's not in black and white colors, because if we say that Putin is bad, so we must say that Biden is good and vice versa. But that's not true. For me, there are two versions of contemporary imperialism, the mainstream liberal imperialism from the US side, from the White House, and the revisionist liberal revisionism from the Kremlin, from official Russia, are clashing. And in that sense, I think that the idea behind the US and the UK behavior in this situation would be just involving Russia into the real war. To let Putin's pass from diplomatic blackmailing to the real fighting, what Boris has said. Because remember, I'm just finishing, that after Vietnam, the US wanted the Soviet Union to do more or less the same thing. And it was the Afghanistan case. Now, after the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, with all humiliating scenes and videos from Kabul airport, the Americans want to Russia to feel the same. So they just attract Putin into the real fighting, understanding that there will be no blitzkrieg.
No, this is a very good segue into my next question, which, you know, we've sort of just opened things up now. And I think in my next question, I want both of you to go into the deeper history of this. So, as you know, because, you know, Oleg, you spoke of revisionism. And so what you're clearly saying is that there is essentially Russia wants to revise the kind of situation that Americans have created, the American dominance has created, etc. So let's dig into that a little bit more. As you know, in recent months, President Putin has presented two treaties with NATO and the United States. And we are told that Foreign Minister Lavrov have requested that the Americans give written responses to their written treaty proposals. And so we are told that this response may be coming this week. Can you explain the rationale of this at the international level? Clearly, these treaties, the writing of these treaties, the proposal of these treaties represents the culmination of the whole arc of U.S.-Russian relations after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. For instance, the rationale for requesting a written response to the is that the original assurance that the U.S. had given that NATO would not expand an inch eastward when Gorbachev agreed to German unification was a verbal one. And it has been violated repeatedly since 1997. And today, when people even discuss this verbal assurance, they said, well, you know, verbal assurances are not worth anything. Of course, Americans were very careful not to give anything in writing. So now the Russians are saying, all right, let's put down in writing what we can agree on about what our mutual borders will be. So can you set the present conjuncture in a broader historical context? We'll begin with you, Oleg, please.
Yeah, I agree with you, Radhika, that maybe this insisting on written guarantees is based on that story from Gorbachev time. When there were diplomatic talks on the German reunification, there was some verbal proposal, and they are mentioned, for example, in the memoirs of Mr. Baker, who was the state secretary at those times, that the Americans proposed to Gorbachev that there will be no NATO enlargement, there will be no nuclear forces in Germany, and so on. And after them, not all of these promises, not all, but many of them were in fact forgotten. And in that sense, this story became quite famous for the domestic Russian propaganda as well, because working for several years at the TV talk shows, I remember that there were many times there was a trend to humiliate Gorbachev as a very bad, very not strong, let's say, leader who just made everything to collapse our great country and so on. And one of the topics to humiliate Gorbachev was exactly to remember these verbal promises. So every people, or almost every people in Russia, not only political expert, remember this thing because of this internal propaganda, anti-Gorbachev propaganda in Putin's times. And that means that now we want, or the Kremlin wants, something written. But what was quite interesting, that the Russian Foreign Ministry made public the Russian proposal of the treaty, which for me is a real kind of ultimatum. So you, the U.S., must not enlarge NATO, you must get out from Ukraine, and we also, and after that we hope that we will be good too. In that sense, there were no Russian obligations of that treaty. So it was a very strong or one-sided proposal of the diplomatic treaty. And for me, it was very strange that it was officially published, because sure, if you'll have some treaty finally signed, I don't think that we'll have anything, but if, sure, it will be much more moderated, much more balanced. And in that sense, everybody can see that the Kremlin, Putin and Lavrov, his foreign minister, just lost the game. So, and for me, it means, because they are not fool people, they are quite rational in that sense, to publish their proposal of the treaty was to blackmail, just to blackmail, just to push the U.S. side to the barrier, and nothing more. And it's also interesting that they became immediately blackmailing. It was published, I think, at the end of November, beginning of December last year. And they said, answer immediately, react immediately. Otherwise, we'll pass. It was a new term in the Russian political slang. We'll pass to military technical measures. What does it mean? Go to the real war or just another step of blackmailing? And so the Americans just said no for almost all Putin's proposals. And now they are just invited him to start a war. What's the question? So if he must keep his words, he must start the war.
Right. So I think you're quite rightly pointing to the internal dynamics of the Russian situation. But maybe both you and Boris can also dwell. I mean, do you think that what's happened over the last 30 years since this dissolution of the Soviet Union, the advancement of NATO, etc., does it have no implications for the Russian state and its security? You know, is there nothing to change? Is there nothing to revise in this?
Well, let me say a few words. First of all, of course, it's very clear that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a tremendous disaster. Among other things, I'm not even speaking about military and diplomatic aspects of the problem. Among other things, it was an economic disaster because it led to breaking economic ties and productive links and cooperation networks around the former Soviet Union, which led to the enormous economic collapse in all the all 15 republics, now all 15 states of the former Soviet Union, by the way, including those ones which are now pretending to be part of the West, like Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, who also faced a real collapse of their economies. And first of all, there is one big problem, that of economic integration. And I think, you know, the main problem, of course, is not on the military side. Of course, we can say that there are a few things which are absolutely scandalous. In that sense, the presence of foreign troops, say in the Baltic republics, is very much a scandalous thing. And of course, we can say that the governments of the Baltics may justify that through, again, the same Russia scare, right? The same Russia scare, saying that having Western troops or having NATO being their partner, being themselves parts members of NATO, is a guarantee of their independence. But the irony of the situation is that Russia already guaranteed their independence. It was Russia which was actually quite ready to recognize these independent states. And there was no attempt on the Russian side to carry out any kind of aggression against them. And on the contrary, you can see if you, I've been to the Baltics quite a lot of times since the independence, there is a systematic aggressiveness on the side of their governments against Russia, which is very provocative. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's more like an attempt to blackmail the West There was no reason to think that Estonia can be aggressive against Russia. I mean, it's very funny, and it's no way that you can expect Estonia to present any threat for Russia. But I think this provocative behavior on the side of the Baltic states is very much an attempt to blackmail the West and force the West into helping them into sending more economic, political, and so on aid to these countries to pull them out of the crisis and so on. So it's a very interesting phenomenon that they pretend to be in a conflict with Russia, but the main thing is that they are actually trying to get more attention from the West.
I think Boris. Let me dig
and,
into
and
that.
It's very similar with Ukraine. I think it's very similar with Ukraine.
Exactly. So let me dig into that a little bit, because the logic is the same, and you are raising a really important point. So you said two things that are really important. Number one, it's not just about military issues; it's about economic issues. And by economic issues, it's very clear that what the West wants, what the Americans want, what even the EU wants, is to keep these former Soviet and former East European communist countries in the Western capitalist ambit, in which they play certain subordinated roles in the larger economic structure of these countries. That's the first thing you said. The second thing you said is that these countries have become sort of, they almost seem to want to blackmail the West into being antagonistic towards Russia. But there's a third thing which links these two things, which is that in order to keep Ukraine, the Baltic republics, all the other Eastern European countries in the Western ambit, the West has supported and maintained in power certain ruling elites, which are precariously positioned in relation to their own populations and reliant completely on Western help and aid.
That was several perspectives on the Russia-Ukraine-U.S. conflict now happening this week in Eastern Europe. We'll try to follow that as best we can in the coming weeks. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all next week for another edition of Conscious Voices. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course. Please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented.